impressed by his ability to recall everything that took place in a game, and not only the games he was in. He used to tell me details about the games I was in, ones I had forgotten long ago, how many points I scored, which players were on the floor, what plays our team ran down the stretch. Perhaps what I admired most, though, was his ability to give credit to others. "You guys were incredible," he told me, referring to the teams I was on in Boston. "Paul was tough." I couldn't believe it. Where I came from, if you said anything positive about a player on the other team, you were seen as a sucker. I always appreciated what my opponents could do on the court, even if it came at my expense. Like me, they had made it this far for a reason. LeBron saw himself as one of the guys, and that's rare for someone of his stature. The stars usually feel the need to separate themselves from everybody else, which is bad for team morale. "I don't care if you average 25 points a night or play 25 minutes a week. If you're on the team, you're an equal. If you think you're better than us, we have a problem." Yet, as devoted as he was, he knew how to have a good time. We'd arrive at the hotel, and I'd no sooner have put my bags down when the phone would ring. "Meet me in my room," he'd say. "We're ready to play cards." "Count me in," I told LeBron, though I typically didn't stay for the whole time. The games on occasion went on until 2 or 3 in the morning, and as the old guy in the group, I needed my rest now more than ever. "I'll be sick in the morning if I don't go to sleep," I told them. That's where their maturity made such a difference. They didn't hold it against me if I didn't spend every minute of my free time with them. It wasn't like that in Boston. If I chose to stay home and not go out to a club with everyone else, I wasn't one of them. It didn't occur to them that I had 5 kids at home, 4 under the age of 7, and that Shannon and I were up at least once a night to keep track of Walker's blood sugar count. Some nights we had to take him to the hospital. It was our new normal, and sleep was rare indeed. I got my best sleep on road trips, though I felt guilty Shannon had to stay up on her own. Being a member of a team, and it can be any team, a law firm, a club in school, a church choir, you name it, can be a tough balancing act. For somebody who sees himself as coming from the outside, it's even tougher. The key is to make sure the others know you are on their side while, at the same time, remaining true to who you are and to what matters to you. So if they ask you to go out and you can't, they won't say, "What the heck is wrong with you? The whole team's going." Instead, they will say, "Ray is with us. He just has stuff to do, and we understand." I was also content on the court itself. This wasn't Boston circa 2007. I wasn't part of the Big Three this time. I was looking forward to the challenge, to be honest, to see the game in a way I hadn't seen it since freshman year at UConn. Just like back then, I still felt that the bench could be as important as the starters. Coming off the bench has its drawbacks, though. You can't ease your way in as you do when you're a starter. You have to catch up in a hurry to the rhythm of the game, and remember, every game is different. Your body also needs to be in the right place, and that's where the Heat could have managed the situation a little better. They ran us ragged, treating us as if we were the youngest team in the league when we were in fact one of the oldest. In Boston, shoot-arounds lasted 40 minutes, sometimes 45. Get some plays down, get some shots up, and get the heck out of there. I would be home, have a nap, and showered by 11:45. In Miami, shoot-arounds lasted about 2 hours. I said something about it out loud once and had to catch myself. "Damn, how long are we going to be out here?" The organization put us through drill after drill, as if we were back in 9th grade trying out for the varsity. We then had to hurry home, get some rest, and be back for a game that night. That was a lot for a body to absorb in one day. I have nothing against shoot-arounds on game day. You need them. But what you need even more is for guys to be at their best, mentally and physically, when the horn sounds. "Why didn't you tell me it was going to be like this?" I asked a teammate I'd known for a while. "I really wanted to," he said, "but I just couldn't. I wanted you to come here." Look, no place is perfect. I'd been around long enough to know that. Eric Spoelstra never played in the league, like Doc did for so many years. So he didn't have the same sense of how we as older players might feel deep into the season. I was more nervous than usual on opening night, and not only because we were playing the Celtics. How they felt about me leaving was actually the least of my concerns after I signed with Miami. Anybody who has moved to another city to take a new job knows what I mean. You worry about finding a school for your kids and a neighborhood to live in. Those are your priorities. I was nervous about the fans. This would be their first time seeing me in a game that mattered, and they would judge me like fans in any city, with no sentimentality. Was it a smart move to sign me? Would I accept my role? Could the old man still play? With just under 3 minutes left in the first quarter, I checked in, and the fans gave me a very warm ovation. No, this would never be Boston, but the folks in Miami always treated me well. A minute later, I made the first shot I took, a three-pointer, and finished with 19 points. So much for nerves. We beat the Celtics 120-107, and went on to win 12 of our first 15. Going into the game against the Pacers on February 1st, we were 29-13. They won easily, 102-89, evening our record on the road to 11-11. We needed to do better, and we did. 2 days later, we knocked off the Raptors in Toronto, then back home, Charlotte, then the Rockets, the Clippers, the Lakers, and so on. We didn't lose again the rest of the month and for the first 3 weeks of March. Defeating the Magic on March 25th made it 27 straight, the longest streak in the league since 1972 when the Lakers won 33 in a row. While everyone was talking about our chance to break the record, I don't remember it being on our minds too much. Getting a ring, that was all we cared about. Sure enough, 2 nights later, the Bulls pulled off the upset, 101-97 in Chicago. You could see it coming. For some teams, the challenge of beating us and ending the streak was something to get up for in a season that was already lost. We finished 66-16, the same record, ironically, the Celtics posted my first year in Boston. Our first opponent in the postseason was the Bucks, who hadn't won a playoff series since I was traded in 2003. We swept them in four, winning each game by double digits. I felt bad for Senator Cole, who sold the team a year later. Next up were the Bulls. Thanks to their explosive guard, Nate Robinson, who had 27 points and 9 assists, they beat us 93-86 at home. But we regrouped to capture Game 2 by 37 and proceeded to take the next three. Then came the Pacers. We were fortunate to escape with Game 1. LeBron making a layup at the buzzer in overtime. We weren't fortunate in Game 2. The Pacers prevailed by 4. Winning at home was almost automatic for us during the regular season, 37-4. That wasn't true any longer. But thanks to 17 points and 7 rebounds from Udonis Haslem in his 10th year with the team, we took Game 3 in Indiana and won the series in 7. I was back in the finals for the third time in 6 seasons. Not once did I take it for granted. Remember, I didn't make a single appearance in my first 11 years. When we lost Game 7 to the Sixers in 2001, I was confident I'd get there before too long. It took 7 years. Standing in our way were the Spurs, who had not won a championship since 2007. That's a drought for that franchise. What always struck me, besides their unselfishness, was how they kept the core of Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, and Manu Ginobili together season after season. Game 1 was in Miami, and again, we couldn't get it done. San Antonio winning 92-88, despite another great performance from LeBron. 18 points, 18 rebounds, 10 assists. Duncan was also at his best. 20 points, 14 rebounds, 3 blocks. Game 2 was now an absolute must, and the guys came through 103-84. Texas, here we come. We should have stayed home. The first half wasn't too bad. The Spurs led 50-44, but the second half couldn't have been worse. They outscored us 63-33. It was our turn in Game 4. We went on a 16-6 run during the fourth quarter to break things open and get back in the series. The Big Three combining for 85 points, 30 rebounds, and 10 steals, 6 by D. Wade. The Spurs took Game 5, 114-104, to go up 3-2. But we had managed to get out of Texas alive, and if we could just win the next two in Miami, the title would be ours. Game 6, as you would expect, was a battle from the opening tip. The Spurs were up by 6 at the half, and extended the lead to 10 after three quarters. We went on a 17-7 run, tying it at 82 with 6.5 minutes left. On the next possession, I hit my first hoop of the night for our first lead since late in the second quarter. Nice of you to drop by, Ray. Down the stretch, neither team was able to take control. With 1.5 minutes to go, Parker tied it with a 3. Then came the 3 straight turnovers. The Spurs now ahead by 5, setting the stage for the final unforgettable 28.2 seconds. Timeout Heat. What did Spoelstra say in the huddle? I can't remember, although I doubt we set up a play. Most times that season in critical possessions, the plan out of a timeout was the same. Give the ball to number 6. Mike Miller, as you may recall, threw it to LeBron, who missed the first 3. But nailed the second after Mike got the loose ball. Then came the free throw from Kawhi Leonard to put San Antonio up by 3. Since we were out of timeouts, Mario Chalmers brought the ball up the full length of the court. It was no secret LeBron was going to take the shot. Still, I was ready. So what if I had just 2 points the whole night? In the Big East championship game against Georgetown, I'd missed my previous 14 shots, when Coach Calhoun called a play for me in our final possession. All it takes is one. You know the rest. I made the 3, we won Game 6 in overtime, and Game 7 two nights later. What a difference a year makes. One year I'm struggling for playing time and respect. The next I'm drinking champagne and riding in another parade. People always want to know which title means more to me. And the truth is, they both mean a great deal. After what I had to endure in Boston, there was a sense of vindication in 2013 that I didn't experience in 2008. I felt that going to Miami was the right decision. The championship confirmed it. Even so, just like in 2008, winning it all didn't change my life. I got to sleep around 5 in the morning after Game 7, but I was up by 8. I thought right away of the tasks I had put off for months, such as going to the dentist. I called to see if they could squeeze me in. "You just won a championship," the receptionist said. "Shouldn't you be on a yacht somewhere partying?" By 9, I was in the chair getting work done on a filling. Sure, I could have waited a few days, but that has never been my approach in basketball or in life. Win a game, you should savor the moment, but don't get too excited. You have to prepare for the next one. So that morning with no games left meant seeing the dentist. That is also why I didn't sit home and watch the highlights on SportsCenter, as members of my family did. Rest on your laurels, and you'll never go any further. Yesterday is over. When I wake up each morning, I ask myself, how can I win this day? And in those weeks after we won the championship, I had something else to think about. Is it time to retire? It wasn't the first time the idea occurred to me. During my last season with the Celtics, I bumped into Steve Kerr, the former Bulls guard and current Golden State coach, in the gym in Miami. Steve was in town to do the commentary for TNT. "What was your process like?" I asked him. "When did you know you needed to retire?" "I knew when I couldn't play without taking anti-inflammatories to allow my body to do it," he said. What Steve told me really hit home. I was taking a lot of medication back then, with no sense of the long-term damage the pills might be doing to my body. The ice baths and stretching were no longer as effective, and the pounding my joints took during games and practices was almost unbearable. Yet I didn't quit. In the end, I thought, how can I leave these guys? I'd been in a lot of locker rooms, some, as you know, where things got quite nasty. This was by far the best one. The last team to win three straight championships was the Lakers in 2002. There was no reason we couldn't do the same. LeBron was still at the top of his game, as were CB and D-Wade, plus the bench was as solid as ever. In early March, we beat the Bobcats to raise our record to 43-14, although Spoelstra was driving as hard as ever, and we always knew the team's president, Pat Riley, was a slump away from getting more involved. The slump came sure enough. A loss in Houston was followed by four more losses in the next five games. Riley came to practice to address the team. We sat against the wall like in some junior high phys ed class. I don't remember what he said. Whatever it was, I'm sure he meant well, although we never got back to the level we were at prior to the slump, ending the season 54-28. No matter. Knowing that we would make the playoffs, there was little to play for. Besides, the guys were exhausted. People always used to tell me, "You are so lucky to be in the NBA." I would never disagree with that, but for us, this was also a job, and every job gets monotonous. In any case, once the playoffs started, we were a different team. No longer were we flying from one city to the next and staying up all hours of the night. We stayed in one place in pursuit of one goal, another title. First, the Bobcats fell in four, the Nets in five, the Pacers in six. The biggest challenge would come next, a rematch against the Spurs. This time, however, they would have the home court. Not for long. After losing the opener by 25, we fought back with a 98-96 victory in Game 2 to take the home court away from them. Now if we could just win the next two in our building, we... Forget it. The next two were as ugly as the scores indicated. 111-92 in Game 3, and 107-86 in Game 4. The Spurs were especially efficient coming out of a timeout. Popovich would get them a high percentage shot every time, and it was not just their stars who beat us. They got major contributions from guards Danny Green and Patty Mills. The series came to a merciful end in Game 5, 104-87, Leonard with 22 points and 10 boards. I started that game, by the way. I was 1-for-8, the basket coming with 5 minutes to go in the first quarter, a three. The guys were pretty down afterward. We didn't expect to lose, and definitely not in five games. I sat in the locker room next to LeBron, who kept shaking his head. In a few weeks, he'd have a decision to make, whether or not to stay in Miami, and the whole sporting world would be watching, as it had in 2010. The whole sporting world, I don't have to tell you, would not be watching to see what I'd decide. Once LeBron chose the Cavs, I knew I would not be returning to Miami. The question was, would I follow him to Cleveland? He did his best to convince me, and I think he probably got tired of trying. If only management valued me as much as he did. The Cavs offered me next to nothing. Minnesota and Memphis showed interest, as did Milwaukee. But the only team to offer a contract above the league minimum was the Houston Rockets. No thanks. The Rockets claimed they wanted to win a championship, but I knew they did not have a chance. So when the training camp started in early October, I stayed in Miami with Shannon and the kids. I was still open to the possibility of joining a team later in the season, maybe around the All-Star break. But no situation was right. And before long, the Cavaliers were playing the Warriors in the 2015 finals. That was the first time I wished I was still out there. I didn't miss the practices, the shoot-arounds, the long plane rides, or the pain in my ankles every morning when I got up. I did miss giving everything I had for something larger than myself. I will always miss that. Soon, another season was underway, and I couldn't let go just yet. I waited to see if the right situation might pop up this time, but it didn't. In the fall of 2016, I announced my retirement. It hit me harder than I thought it would, especially since I had not played a game in 3 years. Knowing it was now official made the reality of it all sink in. Such is the price for investing so much, for so long. I'll never forget the day I realized, for probably the first time, that I could make it in the NBA. I was a freshman at UConn, and we were at practice when Tate George, who made the heroic shot in the NCAA tournament against Clemson in 1990, addressed the team. By this point, Tate, who came to the gym to get some work in, had played for 3 years in the league with the New Jersey Nets. He had our attention. "I'm not the most innately talented guy," he told us, "but I have been part of winning teams, and if you win, you will have a chance." I watched him closely that afternoon. He was right. He wasn't the greatest athlete or the greatest shooter. Yet there he was, exactly where I wanted to be. He watched me as well. "The freshman is better than I was," Tate said to a few others. If he really feels that way, I thought, I better work as hard as I can to make the most of my opportunity. I believe I did. Epilogue. Passing the Baton. One afternoon, when I arrived in the lot at Key Arena, I was surprised to see a car in the spot I had parked in every game day since joining the Sonics in 2003. Fine, it wasn't officially my spot. My name wasn't on the pavement. Still, I was always the first player to show up, often before our trainer, and that was the spot I picked, closest to the entrance. It was mine, and everyone knew it. Recognizing the car, I went straight to the locker room to find my teammate, Antonio Daniels. "Dude, why did you park in my spot?" I asked him. Antonio pleaded ignorance. It was time for my workout. The two of us would have to talk about this later. That night, I believe we were playing the Knicks, I scored about 40 points. I couldn't miss. In the locker room, afterward, Antonio couldn't resist. "And I parked in your spot," he said, laughing. "Maybe I should park in your spot more often." "Shut up," I said jokingly, "and never park in my spot again." He didn't, and neither did anyone else. I know what you are thinking. Why would I care so much about a silly parking spot? Because one day it's a parking spot, and the next, Antonio is taking shots with me in the gym, affecting how I go through my normal workout. Before you know it, my entire routine is off. And my routine, remember, is what helped me build my confidence during my 18 years in the league, one step at a time. Show me the person who sticks to his routine day after day, and I know he's the one you can depend on. On a basketball team, in a law firm, in any group of people in pursuit of a common goal. And in those 18 years, I felt a huge sense of responsibility every time I stepped on the floor. Not just to the franchise I played for, or my teammates, my coach, or the fans. I felt a responsibility to the game, to those who came before me, and to those who would come after. I felt it my rookie year, when I was so warmly welcomed by Michael Jordan and Mitch Richmond and others who had been around for a while. "Take care of this," they seemed to be telling me, without saying those exact words. "When it's time for us to go, we will pass the baton to you. Make sure to leave the game in better shape than when you got here, and make sure you give the same speech to the next generation of players. No one, after all, is bigger than the game. Not Wilt, Dr. J, Michael, Larry, Magic, LeBron. No one. Each of us had to overcome something to get as far as we did. Our background, our limitations, our doubts. Something that stopped many others, and probably should have stopped us, but didn't. A lot of times when I was ready to give up for the day, I thought of Michael and Reggie or anyone else I measured myself against. They're not giving up. They're still taking shots. They're still on the treadmill. I'm not giving up either. You don't become a champion the day you beat the other team. You become a champion the day you commit to giving your best, no matter what the obstacles may be. Will you be judged? You better believe it, and the judgment might be harsher than you deserve, but that's no excuse to give anything less. You see, I could have been like some of those kids I grew up with in South Carolina, who never thought they could make it as a professional athlete. There were, after all, no examples around town to show them the way. Instead, I realized early on that while life isn't always fair, you can't allow yourself to think that you're a victim, or that is precisely what you will be. Which is why today, in my early 40s, I could not be more at peace. I am both a coach and an owner, a coach to my 5 kids who depend on my leadership every day, and an owner to the employees who work for Grown, the organic fast food restaurants Shannon and I opened a couple of years ago in Florida and Connecticut. In each role, I often reflect back on those people who encouraged me in and out of basketball, and on those who tried to hold me back. The lessons from both are endless and timeless. As a father, I hope to prevent my 4 boys, Ray Ray, 13, Walker, 11, Wynn, 8, and Whiston, 5, and my daughter, Tierra, 25, from making poor decisions, but always keeping in mind that I can't make decisions for them, as my parents couldn't for me. And as an owner, I hope my workers know how much I care about them, but also that I will hold them accountable, like those who kept me in line. Shannon and I were going for a drive one day in Connecticut when we passed by a playground. 3 kids about high school age were playing basketball. I stopped the car. "You have room for one more?" They sure did. I took some shots to warm up, and it wasn't long before they recognized me, from my days at UConn, no doubt. This was the summer after my rookie season in Milwaukee. Anyway, we played a game of 21 until I had to go. But before I did, I went to the car and handed each of them a pair of sneakers I had in the trunk. Man, I wish you could have seen the look on their faces. For the longest time, I thought I had stopped for them, to inspire these kids to keep dreaming and to believe in themselves. Truth is, I stopped for myself, for that kid on the playground in Dalzell, who dreamed the same dream these boys did, who didn't have an NBA player show up one day, who kept dreaming nonetheless. That kid is never far away. More than the thousands of shots I hit in college and the pros, the shots I took in the playgrounds remain the ones that mean the most. There were no fans or cheerleaders, just a group of us playing for the pure love of the game. You win, you give everyone high fives and take on the next team. You lose, you sit down. And believe me, no one ever wanted to sit down. The best part was that what we did on those playgrounds, and in high school too, was not captured on video. No, those games instead occupy a much more special place. Your imagination. Whenever you did something spectacular, it spread through word of mouth, and before long it became urban legend. Several years ago, a stranger reminded me of a play I made in a game against West Florence during my senior year at Hillcrest. I remember it well. My teammate, who was out of bounds, lobbed the ball to me near the rim, where I was to catch it and slam it home. We ran this play all the time. Only this time, the pass was too high and was certain to bounce off the glass. Yet as I jumped, it felt as normal as it could be, as if I had jumped this high my entire life. I caught the ball and threw it down. It was one of the best dunks I ever had. "You were as high as the backboard," the guy said. "I never saw anything like it." One day I'm sure I'll see another group of kids playing hoop in some playground, and I'll stop the car again. I might be an old man by then, and they won't have the slightest idea who I am. But the kid inside of me will still be there, remembering when I was like them, just me, my dreams, and the game I loved. You have room for one more? This is J.D. Jackson. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of From the Outside, My Journey Through Life and the Game I Love by Ray Allen with Michael Arkush. This program was produced by Mosaic Audio. The director was Michael Straza. Executive producer Suzanne Mitchell. Text copyright 2018 by Walter Ray Allen Jr. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.